Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are really cutting through the noise today to get straight to the heart of a legendary investment strategy.
That's right. We're plunging into the foundational philosophy of Philip A. Fisher.
Mostly looking through the lens of his big work, Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits, but also the really helpful additions from his son, Kenneth Fisher.
Yeah, this is a deep exploration into what makes a business truly exceptional, you know? Our mission today is basically to distill that core philosophy.
How do you, the investor, find those, well, outstanding long-term growth companies?
Exactly. The ones that generate serious wealth over decades, and importantly, without demanding you perfectly time the market, which is, let's face it, pretty much impossible.
Right.
It's a method that it requires real work, deep investigation, and honestly, a rare kind of resolve to ignore what everyone else is doing, the crowd sentiment.
And what's great, I think, is how notoriously difficult this philosophy can be, even for someone like Kenneth Fisher, who grew up with it.
Oh, yeah. That anecdote is fantastic.
He shares this story right at the start, reading his dad's book at age 8. And he just remembers it being a frustrating, you know, waste of the start of a perfectly good summer vacation.
It was so dense, right?
Exactly. And he admits it took him like 15 years to really get it.
Wow.
That detail alone tells you, okay, this is pretty radical thinking. It's worth the mental effort.
It absolutely is. I mean, Fisher's work is foundational stuff. It influenced huge investors, Warren Buffett being the obvious one.
Right.
And the core focus, it's never about short-term predictions or, you know, market noise. It's purely on figuring out the underlying business characteristics, the things that ensure long-term, really superior growth.
Okay, let's unpack this then. If we think about the world before Fisher, a lot of investing was about timing the market, right? Buying low, selling high. So what's the fundamental difference with his approach?
Well, that traditional cyclical investing, especially, you know, before robust regulation like the Fed and the SEC came along pre-1913, it relied on buying into sectors during a bust and selling during the boom. And yeah, that strategy could be lucrative.
Sure.
But Fisher argues, and pretty convincingly, I think, that the maximum reward, the really big wins, come not from timing cycles, but from finding that that rare company, the one that just consistently outpaces its competitors for decades.
And sticking with it.
And sticking with it. Finding those outstanding companies and staying put, even through all the market ups and downs, was historically way more profitable and maybe surprisingly less risky than constantly trying to guess the economic tide.
And when you say profitable, we're talking serious wealth creation here. The numbers are pretty staggering.
They really are.
The material shows like $10,000 invested 25, maybe 50 years ago in the right kind of uncommon company.
Yeah.
Could balloon to $250,000 or even several times that. And often you didn't even need to buy at the absolute bottom of the market.
Exactly. The greatest investment reward comes from finding that occasional company keyword there. Occasional, that can grow its sales and profits way faster than the industry overall. And then you just lock that capital away for a long, long time.
Okay.
And here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Fisher actually argued that current investment opportunities, well, they might be better than they were in the past.
Wait, better? How could that be with markets feeling so much more crowded now?
Yeah, it's definitely counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
But he points to how management itself has evolved.
Oh.
Think about it. Maybe a generation or two ago, corporate bosses often treated their company like a personal kingdom, you know,
yeah,
resisting outside ideas, criticism.
Right. The fiefdom mentality.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But today, management is generally forced, really, into continuous self-analysis, innovation, hiring experts, using aggressive R&D just to stay alive.
Mm.
That intense competitive pressure actually creates more possibilities for sustained growth, not just short bursts.
You can see that really clearly in the R&D spending figures he mentions from the mid-20th century.
Absolutely. Corporate research spending just exploded back then. By 1959, you had major industries saying, look, 15 to 20% of our sales next year, they'll come from products that didn't even exist 3 years ago.
Wow, that's incredible speed.
It is. And that relentless focus on growth, it's essential. Because in a world that's always changing, always competitive, a company basically has two choices, grow or shrink. There's not much middle ground.
Yeah.
As Fisher put it, a strong offense is the best defense.
Okay, so that's the philosophy. Growth, long-term, find the best.
Yeah.
But how do you find them? This brings us to the actual method, right? What Kenneth Fisher called the two jewels.
Yep, the scuttlebutt method and the 15 points.
Scuttlebutt sounds, well, it sounds like gossip.
Huh. It kind of does, but it's much more systematic.
Yeah.
The 15 points provide the structure, like a checklist of what to look for, but Scuttlebutt is really the engine that drives the discovery.
So what is it exactly?
It's an intensive qualitative investigation technique. It means getting out of your armchair, you know, away from just reading press releases and annual reports. You have to systematically talk to people connected to the company. Its customers, its competitors, its suppliers, even former employees.
So you're building this sort of intelligence profile from the outside in, completely separate from Wall Street analysts.
Precisely.
But how do you know if the information is any good? I mean, if you talk to a competitor, aren't they just going to trash the company you're looking at?
So that's where the art comes in. You absolutely have to cross-check everything. You have to weigh the source's reliability.
Right.
Like you said, competitors might have an agenda. Former employees might talk freely. Sure. But if they feel they were fired unfairly, their view is going to be skewed, obviously.
Makes sense.
So Scuttlebutt works because you're triangulating. If you hear the same positive story about a great product, maybe, or a really innovative culture from customers and suppliers, and even grudgingly from competitors, then you know you probably found something real.
Got it. So it's a powerful filter against just hype and, you know, marketing spin.
Exactly. Think about those examples from the early 2000s tech boom, right? Yeah. The dot-com bubble.
Yeah, the pipe dream companies.
Could those have passed a rigorous Scuttlebutt test? Almost certainly not.
Why not?
Well, if you really dug in, talked to the people on the ground, competitors probably weren't genuinely scared of most of them. Customers and suppliers likely wouldn't have been overly impressed either, because the actual sustainable sales volume, or maybe the real technological advantage, it just wasn't there yet.
Mm.
Scuttlebutt helps you see if the story the company tells about itself matches the reality experienced by everyone else interacting with it.
Okay, so Scuttlebutt verifies the external reality. Then you apply the framework of the 15 points.
That's the idea.
Kenneth Fisher had that great distillation, didn't he? The gist of the 15 points, the real core of what to buy, came down to that one question his father loved to ask.
Oh yeah, the stunningly cunning question. What are you doing that your competitors aren't doing yet?
The emphasis on yet is key, isn't it? It implies not just being innovative now, but staying ahead, forcing others to play catch up.
Exactly. That commitment to leading the market, driving it, that's crucial. And if we touch on just a couple of those 15 points.
Yeah.
One big one is management depth.
Okay.
Sure, a small company might do great for a while with one brilliant visionary leader at the helm. But if you're investing for the long, long term, you absolutely need depth below that top person.
And what's a warning sign there?
A big red flag is when the CEO or top brass is constantly interfering in routine day-to-day stuff.
Micromanaging.
Yeah, basically. It shows they either don't trust the people under them, or worse, they haven't developed capable leaders who can be trusted. That's not sustainable for growth.
And you also need to look past just the current profit numbers, right? Margins matter, but not just in a snapshot.
Precisely. You have to look for worthwhile profit margins, sure, but study them over a series of years, not just one good year. Because those marginal companies, the ones with inner profits, they often show bigger percentage jumps in the good times.
Ah, looks impressive.
Looks very impressive. Gives you a false sense of dynamism. But then, come a downturn, they fall much, much faster. That volatility is a big risk signal.
And the last point you wanted to highlight was integrity, which sounds obvious, but it's more than just avoiding outright fraud, isn't it?
Oh, much more. It's really about the fundamental relationship between management and the owners and the shareholders. It's about trusteeship.
Meaning
managers have to operate with a genuine sense of responsibility to the stockholders, not just paying lip service to it.
Okay.
A concrete example Fisher pointed out was abuses around stock options. You know, management issuing themselves options far beyond what any objective outsider would consider fair compensation for their actual contribution.
Right, lining their own pockets.
That kind of self-dealing just kills the trust you need for a true long-term partnership between investors and the company.
Okay, so we've covered the what to look for, the growth potential, the management, the margins, the integrity, and how to investigate using Scuttlebutt and the 15 points. Let's pivot now to the don'ts for investors. These seem just as important for avoiding common mistakes.
Absolutely critical. These don'ts often go right against conventional wisdom, which is why they're so valuable.
Like the first big one, don't overstress diversification. That flies directly in the face of what most people are taught about portfolio construction.
It really does. Fisher thought the percentage of investors holding, say, 25 or more stocks was, his word was, appalling.
Appalling? Why? Isn't diversification supposed to reduce risk?
It's about knowledge versus just quantity. His point was, if you diversify that much, you inevitably end up putting too little money into the companies you actually understand really well.
Okay.
And conversely, you're forced to put too much money into companies you know almost nothing about just to fill up those slots in the portfolio.
So quality over quantity.
Definitely. He suggested that for most individual investors, maybe 10 or 12 stocks is a much better number. It allows you to maintain that deep, intimate knowledge of each business you own.
Mm.
If you truly understand and trust the businesses, real diversification comes from owning solid companies in different types of industries, not just piling up stock symbols you barely recognize.
Okay, that makes sense. The second big don't is also pretty contrarian. It's about dividends.
Oh, yes, dividends.
Most investors love dividends, right? They see that high yield as income, maybe even a sign of safety. But Fisher warned against overstressing them. Why is keeping the earnings often better?
This comes down to opportunity and taxes, really.
Yeah.
A high dividend yield, he argued, is explicitly not a factor of safety in itself.
Okay.
Think about it. If a company has fantastic opportunities to reinvest its earnings, maybe in R&D, for new products, building new factories, expanding into new markets, and those investments can generate, say, a 15 or 20% return,
yeah.
Well, the absolute best use of that money is to keep it and reinvest it right back into the business.
Because of compounding.
Compounding and the tax advantage for you, the investor. It's huge.
Yeah.
Those reinvested earnings grow and compound tax deferred until you finally sell the stock, maybe years or decades down the line.
Whereas if they paid it out...
If they pay it out as a dividend, you pay income tax on that cash immediately, right now. That shrinks the amount you have left to reinvest or compound yourself. It's just less efficient.
So you actually want a management team that's smart enough to see dividends as like an outflow that needs justification, not just something they have to pay.
Precisely. If a management team starts boosting the dividend when they still have really good reinvestment opportunities on the table, it's like Fisher used an analogy, like a farmer rushing his best livestock to market before they're fully grown just to get some cash now.
You get a little bit now, but you sacrifice much more future growth.
Exactly. It's a frightful cost, as he put it.
Okay. That leads us nicely into the psychological side of things. What Fisher calls the fourth dimension, the appraisal by the financial community. This seems key for timing your purchases, even if you plan to hold long term.
It is absolutely key. And this is where Fisher just directly takes on the whole efficient market idea.
Right. The theory that prices always reflect all known information.
He basically said, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
At any given time, prices very often do not fully reflect everything that's known. And the biggest opportunities, they pop up when the financial community, you know, Wall Street, has seriously misjudged a fundamentally good situation.
And that misjudgment, that sort of change in perception or appraisal, creates the buying window.
Exactly. Often triggered by some temporary dip in enthusiasm or maybe bad news that isn't actually fatal to the long-term story.
He used that Raychem Corporation example, right?
In the 70s.
Yeah, great example. Mid-1970s, Raychem's management comes out and says, look, we need to do some restructuring. It's necessary, but it's going to hurt earnings for a couple of quarters.
Now, the underlying business was still strong, but the stock, which was around $23, just sat there. It went nowhere. The market, the financial community, was just too shell-shocked from recent downturns, too pessimistic to believe management's explanation.
They didn't buy the story.
They didn't buy the story. But because the fundamentals were sound, earnings recovered and grew exactly like management predicted they would.
And then the stock.
And then the market finally changed its appraisal. It wasn't just valuing the higher earnings. The whole price-to-earnings ratio, the PE, expanded because investors suddenly had renewed confidence in management's credibility. The stock more than doubled pretty quickly after that period of sitting flat.
Wow. So the lesson there is really about patience and trusting your own deep research over the market's sort of immediate emotional reaction.
Absolutely. And it also underlines why, if you do own one of these great businesses, trying to be cute and sell it just because it seems temporarily overvalued.
Hoping to buy it back cheaper later.
Yeah, that's often a huge mistake. It's probably the most common and costly error long-term investors make.
Why?
Because the truly great growth stocks, they often just keep surprising you on the upside. They blow past what seemed like a high valuation and reach totally new levels. The risk of selling and then missing out on those massive subsequent gains, or maybe switching your money into a company that isn't nearly as good, that risk is usually way bigger than the risk of just holding on through a period where the stock might be a little bit ahead of itself.
Okay, so pulling this all together, what does this entire philosophy really boil down to for you, the investor listening right now? What's the takeaway in terms of effort?
Well, it boils down to work. Hard, focused, intelligent work. Finding these kinds of stocks is definitely not an armchair activity where you just read a few brokerage reports.
No shortcuts.
No shortcuts. Fisher said success requires great effort combined with ability and enriched by both judgment and vision. It's demanding.
But the payoff is potentially huge.
Potentially massive. Think about the difference over, say, 20 years between a company that grows its earnings at 12% a year versus one that manages 20%. The difference in your final wealth is just vast.
Right.
And that difference is absolutely worth the trouble, worth the digging, worth maybe even paying capital gains taxes if you find a truly superior prospect and need to make a switch.
And the biggest mistake isn't necessarily buying a bit too high or selling a bit too low in the short term.
No. The most costly error, by far, is selling a truly great company. He uses Motorola as an example elsewhere, mm-hmm. just because, you know, it had a huge rise and maybe it's temporarily overpriced. Letting go of those compounders too early is the real killer.
Okay, that brings us perfectly to our final provocative thought for you to take away. It's really about leveraging the power of time.
Yeah. Think about this fundamental rule Fisher laid out. The further into the future profits will continue to grow, the higher the price-earnings ratio an investor can afford to pay.
So look way beyond next quarter's earnings.
Exactly. It challenges you, the listener, to think critically. Which companies out there today really exhibit that necessary vivid spirit, that, you know, determined innovative personality Fisher talked about?
And the discipline.
And long-range discipline required to really dominate their market, not just for the next year or two, but potentially for the next decade or more. That's the ultimate question you need to answer to unlock those uncommon profits.